What's the first thing I want to do after we have a different president? Take a shower.
Impeachment is about cleansing the office.
Now, mind you, the heretofore document had dry ink on it for at least many fork nights
We signed it a long time ago.
It was a long time ago signed.
I thought you said the law was powerless.
Powerless to help you, not punish you.
Welcome to Opening Arguments, the podcast that pairs an inquisitive interviewer with a real-life lawyer. This podcast is sponsored by the law offices of P. Andrew Torres, LLC, for entertainment purposes, is not intended as legal advice, and does not form an attorney-client relationship. Don't take legal advice from a podcast.
Hello, and welcome to Opening Arguments. This is episode 346. I'm Thomas. That's Andrew. How are you doing, Andrew?
I am fantastic. I'm full of holiday cheer. I had a lovely Christmas. I assume you did the same.
I assume I did too. Tell you what, probably enjoyed several fine Italian bottles of wine from our new first annual wine exchange that we're now doing between Andrew and I. I think it was meant to be. I'm glad we're doing this.
And I actually did crack open the now 6-year-old aged eggnog that I've had in my fridge, which is it's amazing. It's the scotch of eggnogs, Thomas. Like it's so good.
All right. Well, I know a lot of people don't react well to that, but
that's why I talk about it.
It seems weird. Like it's nothing. Eggnog, I think, is exclusively perishable stuff. Like there's no cream, eggs. Whatever other milk products, but okay. Seems like that shouldn't be possible.
That's the whole game, right? Is to preserve cream and eggs for years at a time. The secret is an unbelievable amount of whiskey. So,
Is it just it's not just like you open an oven, it's blue cheese?
No, it is delicious. Smooth and rich, and it's amazing.
Well, we'll take your word for it. All right. Well, it's time for an interview. We've got an interview with Lawrence Lessig about faithless electors, and I think we probably should hop right on over to it. What do you think?
Yeah, let's do it.
And welcome back to Opening Arguments, Professor Lawrence Lessig. Professor Lessig, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. Last time we got way into the weeds on Article 5 conventions, and so I thought that it made sense to have you back to discuss a couple recent cases that you're involved in that relate to the Electoral College. Maybe kind of as an initial matter, what are your thoughts on the Electoral College in general, right? And you know, obviously there are, you know, there's the Interstate Compact effort. You know, there are various efforts to try and abolish or undermine, change the Electoral College. What are your thoughts at it on a structural level?
Well, I think it's the most misunderstood institution, except for Article 5, within the Constitution. You know, I mean, there's this perception that the biggest problem with the Electoral College is that it increasingly seems to elect the loser as the winner. And there's this perception on the right that the greatest thing about the Electoral College is that it benefits small states over big states. And my view is the greatest problem is not that it elects losers rather than winners. And the reality is it doesn't benefit small states over large states. Hmm. The problem with the Electoral College is that in every election, it is an election focused on the swing states. And the swing states in 2016, 14 states, which received 95% of campaign events and 99% of campaign spending, those 14 states are just not representative of America. They're older, they're whiter, their industry is kind of late 19th century, early 20th century industry. You know, there are 7.5 times the number of people in America focused on solar energy as mine coal. But you never hear about solar energy in presidential campaigns because those people live in Texas and in California. You hear about coal miners because those people come from swing states. So the problem with the Electoral College is that winner take all has evolved the institution into an institution that represents not America. It's not America that is electing our president. And, you know, if we're going to outsource the selection of our president to another country, I'm not sure it would be the swing states I would select. So, you know, I think we need to focus on, like, how do we get an electoral college at least that represents America rather than something that has nothing to do with America?
I do have ask, could you go into detail on why it doesn't favor small states? Because that sounded, maybe I'm just totally misinformed, but it seemed like it gives small states way more leverage per person than larger states, doesn't it?
You're absolutely right that the per capita electoral vote is larger in Wyoming than in California. But the question is, where do presidential candidates focus their attention, and where do they bend policy to favor in order to get elected or reelected president? And the overwhelming evidence is that is swing states. Look, if you're running for president, you're a Republican, it makes no sense to spend a single second or a single dollar in either California or Wyoming, because both California and Wyoming are set regarding you. You are never going to win California, and you are certainly going to win Wyoming. So you don't care about California and you don't care about Wyoming because those places are not going to affect your election. What you care about are swing states. Now, some swing states are small states, New Hampshire, but it's accidental that it's a small state. It's just because it is a politically divided state that it's a swing state. Most of the swing states, like Pennsylvania, Florida, Ohio, Michigan, these are large states. And so it's not small states that are getting the power in the actual selection of our president. It is these arbitrarily selected swing states that, you know, shift slightly election to election, but never have any direct relation to representing America generally or representing small states in particular.
Well, I hear you on that, but I suppose the counterargument would be like if these small states didn't have some number of electoral votes that they do based on this system, then maybe we wouldn't even get to the point where we have these swing states. But I understand what you're saying. Like, it does focus the campaigning on these certain swing states. I get what you're
saying. Right. But I'm saying more than campaigning. You know, that there's a really great book, The Particularistic President by Kreiner and Reeves, that actually maps policy decisions by presidential administrations with respect to these swing states. And what they find is not only spending, which is hugely inflated in swing states versus the rest of the country, but even regulations get bent to benefit swing states against the interests of the rest of the country. And the most recent and obvious example of this is when Trump was elected president, he very quickly eliminated the offshore drilling ban. Florida had an exemption from that almost immediately. And New Jersey couldn't even get a hearing because New Jersey is not a swing state. Who cares about New Jersey? But Florida is a critical state. You can't be a Republican president without winning Florida. And so what that means is Florida had more power simply because they're a swing state, not because they're a small state. They're not. Not because they represent America. They don't. Because they're a swing state. That's the problem with the Electoral College. And it doesn't happen once every five elections or once every 10 elections. It happens in every single election. And the point is that's the problem we ought to be figuring out how to solve.
Okay, I think that makes a lot of sense. So let's kind of transition into these two lawsuits, right? Which we on episode 309 we broke down the Baca versus Hickenlooper decision in the Tenth Circuit. You're involved in a couple of different lawsuits that arise out of the 2016 sort of post-electoral effort. I think you called it Electors Trump. Was that right?
No. I was involved in an organization that provided legal advice through something called the Electors Trust. It was basically just a nonprofit that allowed electors to ask questions about their rights as electors. There was another project called Hamilton Electors.
Yes.
Who were, you know, it was a project, I was not involved in this, but I knew about them at the time. It was a project to recruit electors across the country to vote for a third candidate like Kasich to basically assure that the election got thrown into the House, and then the House could decide who the president should be between Trump, Kasich, and Clinton.
Right. And it seemed like, although, you know, that was a obviously a pretty long shot strategy to try and convince 37 Trump electors to become faithless electors. But the reasoning behind it, I could at least follow, right, which was, OK, you have an institutional House of Representatives at the time, you know, which was not yet under the sway of Donald Trump. And if you give them the choice between a total wild card Republican in Donald Trump and an institutional one of their own in John Kasich, then they're likely to vote for Kasich. They're not likely. They, as we knew at the time, they would not prefer, you know, Hillary Clinton over Donald Trump, for example. And so both of these lawsuits sort of track what happened with particular faithless electors. I guess my first question from a factual basis, and, you know, depending on your involvement with the organizations, you know, maybe you have access, maybe you don't. All of these were Democratic electors who, in the Colorado case, either voted for or wanted to vote for Kasich. In the Washington case, who split and voted for mostly for Colin Powell for president. Do you know what the thought process was with respect to having Democratic electors defect? Was it just lack of coordination with Republican electors, or, you know, what was the thought process there?
Well, what I know about those conversations was that at the time, there was a very concerted effort by the Hamilton electors to reach out to Republican electors and basically structure the intervention of voting contrary to your pledge in order to move the election into the House. And the original aspiration, again, I wasn't on the inside of this, but this is what was reported to me. The original aspiration was Democrats would have to demonstrate good faith by voting contrary to Clinton if they were going to get Republicans to vote to demonstrate or to be willing to risk voting against Trump. And so the Democrats that were lined up by Baca in Colorado in particular were about, you know, trying to be part of a bigger strategy to try to affect the movement into the House. Separate from that, there was an effort by some to identify Republican electors, independent of the Hamilton Electors Project, who did not support Trump or did not want Trump to be president and who would vote contrary to Trump. And I understand from a person at the center of that project, a guy named R.J. Lyman, who is a Republican from Massachusetts, that he had a substantial number, more than 20 of those electors, who were willing to consider voting contrary to Trump if he could get to the magic number of 37. Like, they were not going to put their neck out unless there was a reason to. Now, of course, Chris Supran in Texas was a Republican elector who voted contrary to Trump because he thought that was his obligation. So it's not like there were no Republican electors that voted contrary to Trump, but this effort to mobilize electors to vote contrary to their pledge was pretty big at the time. And one thing that stopped it was the subject of these lawsuits, which is, do they actually have the right, constitutional right, to vote contrary to their state, the vote of their state, or contrary to their pledge as electors?
Yeah. And in taking that sort of into account for 2020, my view is that what I really appreciate about these decisions coming out now and the continued efforts to litigate them is that if you have an ambiguous rule right now, and we can talk, to what extent you think the rule, you know, that is the notion that electors, presidential electors, have the constitutional right to vote their conscience. I would rather, given that we have an activist Supreme Court, I think we can take that as read. I would rather have the rule decided in advance before we know whether the application of that rule is going to benefit Donald Trump in 2020 or whether it's going to benefit his Democratic challenger. It's pretty easy to imagine, you know, both scenarios coming into play.
Oh, my gosh. That is so obviously right. And, you know, we had a pause and just bathe in the joy of recognizing issues which nobody should disagree with. Like, this is one of those issues. I don't care what your politics is. You ought to agree that whatever you want the result to be, you want the result to be that before we're in the middle of a presidential election. And what we've, you know, what we've believed from the very beginning is, you know, if you look at the demographics of the United States and the way the Electoral College is going to work over the next 10 cycles, it is going to increasingly be a close contested election, regardless of how popular these candidates are. That's just the way the Electoral College is going to work, which means the chance of actually having electors who are tempted to flip the result in a particular election is going up dramatically. And so we just need to know, do they have that power? Because if they have that power, then America needs to decide whether they want to keep it like that or want to change it. But we ought to do that before we're forcing the court to say, yes, it turns out the law entails that this elector can switch the results and make Donald Trump a second term president or make a Democrat a president, even though Donald Trump otherwise would have won the Electoral College.
Yeah. And so from a litigation strategy perspective, what are you doing to make sure that that rule gets decided in advance?
Well, so our strategy was we brought two cases, one in Washington State and one in Colorado. The Washington State case was the clearer, simpler case to bring because in that case, three electors were actually fined $1,000 each. And so there's no question of standing. There's no right to there's no question about the right to challenge the law. The question is that law constitutional or not? In the Tenth Circuit, it was a harder case to structure because in the Tenth Circuit, what happened is the Secretary of State basically removed one elector and threatened two others. So we brought a 1983 action against the Secretary of State that basically said, you know, this is vote intimidation. You violated the voting rights of these electors by removing one because you didn't like his vote and threatening two others because you didn't like how they intended to vote. Now, the idea was to move both of these cases through and ideally to get a split between the two of them. I mean, we think the Supreme Court should take this case whether or not there's a split, given exactly what we've just reflected on. But, you know, the court seems so focused on whether there's a split in authority, we wanted to be able to produce the split. And, you know, I'm glad that in some sense we've produced the ideal split because it's going to be cleaner for the Supreme Court to review the Washington case, which we lost. The Washington Supreme Court held that electors should be fined for voting contrary to their pledge, than it is for us to get to review the Tenth Circuit case, which is complicated by 1,000 other questions of like standing and whether there should be a case or contrary, you know, all those other complications that the court had to work through before it actually got to the constitutional rule. But the Tenth Circuit opinion is just brilliant in its comprehensiveness and its careful attention to every single issue that there is in deciding what the ultimate answer to the question should be. So right now what's happening is where, you know, the Tenth Circuit, the Washington Attorney General's office has been extremely mature and professional about trying to make sure that this question gets resolved before the next election. I mean, they have their view. It's not our view. But we all agree that we ought to resolve this before it has a consequential effect on an election. So what we're trying to do right now is to figure out what the right ordering of the cert petitions or timing of the cert petition should be. My preference is that it is the Tenth Circuit, it's the Washington Supreme Court that the court is focused on in resolving the question, but there's a chance that both of the cases get taken up and the court would, you know, have two cases that it would consider, one Washington and the other the Tenth Circuit, and have to write an opinion that in some sense resolves both of them.
So you have an agreement with the state of Washington in that case to extend the time for filing a cert petition, because I know that decision came out, I believe, at the end of May.
Well, we didn't get an agreement from Washington. Justice Kagan, who's the circuit justice for the Ninth Circuit, gave us an extension to file the cert petition. And the reason we gave was that the Tenth Circuit was still deciding its case, and we thought the court would be in a better position to decide on the cert petition once the 10th Circuit had decided. Now they have. Sure. They've created a split. So we in principle could file today, but what we're doing is talking to the attorney general in Colorado to figure out what they're going to do and to coordinate the timing to give the court the best opportunity to hear and resolve the issues.
Yeah. Does Colorado want to appeal the Baca decision? I mean, obviously, you would have grounds to appeal as well on behalf of the two faithless electors who were allegedly intimidated, but who were not replaced. But obviously, you prevailed on standing for Michael Baca.
Yeah, we would not appeal that decision. I mean, what's significant is the attorney general has not asked for rehearing en banc. Mm. So now the only question is whether they file cert. And at this stage, I understand there's not a decision that's been made, but we've been talking to them to figure out if they did, what the timing would be. Would we join each other in saying that, yes, cert ought to be granted in both, which, you know, we'd be fine with. But the only thing that's really important to us is that at least the Washington case should be there, so that the court mm-hmm. has a chance to consider it without having to wade through the 60 pages of preliminary questions to be able to get to the ultimate question of constitutional power.
Yeah, we did, I think, 80 or 90 minutes on Baca, so I sympathize with that. So procedurally, the posture you would prefer would be for the Supreme Court just cleanly to take up the Guerra decision, and then for the 10th Circuit decision to just stand and to note that there's a it's not a split among the circuits, but it's a split between Washington State and 10th Circuit. Okay, yeah, that makes sense. I worry. So when I try and play chess behind what I think this Supreme Court will do, I wonder if there is a way to sort of narrowly rule on the facts that that is then consistent with both decisions. And it might go something like this, to say, look, the Washington State opinion says that there is not an absolute right, unfettered right for an elector to do whatever he wants, he or she wants. We're not called upon to pass judgment upon that in this case, because the injury that was inflicted in Washington, the faithless electors' votes still counted, right? They were just fined, and then presumably those fines were paid on their behalf by a nonprofit or by a political party. And the harm, the real harm, was the unique statute in Colorado that enabled the state to actually replace an elector and replace, in that case, Michael Baca's vote. Could you see, a Roberts court kind of trying to narrowly confine it to the facts to leave the ultimate question open? And B, if I'm right on that, how would you want to navigate around that?
Well, the facts aren't like that. Nobody paid the fine on behalf of the Washington electors. They're on the hook for that. Mm-hmm. So there really is a question whether they can be personally monetarily fined. There was an amazing exchange that I had when I was arguing the case in Washington, where the Chief Justice of the Washington Supreme Court said, well, of course, they have their freedom to vote however they want. They just are fined if they vote the wrong way, to which the response is McCulloch versus Maryland, right? Right. the Bank of the United States had the freedom to circulate their bills in Maryland. They just were fined if they did so without paying the tax. So, there's no logical ability to hold that. There's no logical ability to hold that the state has no power to control how the electors vote, but the state has the power to fine them if they don't like their vote. I mean, that's just what it means to have the freedom, the constitutional discretion to vote how you want. And so we think that both cases have to be decided together. Now, one of the things that's leading us to be more patient about whether to grant and whether to join a cert in the grant and grant in the 10th Circuit is whether that's logically true or not. I think there's some people who think that the 10th Circuit presents the more egregious intervention by the state, and the court might want to uphold the power of electors to actually cast their vote but find some way to be sanguine about penalizing the electors. And the way you get to that position is you say, well, you know, there's nothing wrong with the state saying the only people we will nominate to be electors are those who have made a pledge to one candidate or the other. That's Ray versus Blair. Mm-hmm. And we don't see any problem with the pledge because it's not about how they vote. It's about the distinction. It's about the decision to select them. And that judgment is vested in the state. So the state's allowed to discriminate between those who make a pledge and those who don't. And that's why Ray versus Blair is correct. Well, if you can do that, could you say to the elector, all right, if you're going to be an elector, you've got to put $10,000 up in a bond or, you know, held. And if you cast the vote in the right way, you get that money back. If you don't cast the vote in the right way, we keep that money. Or you got to give us a check for $1,000. And if you cast it in the right way, we'll return it. You don't cast it in the right way, we won't return it. My own view is that all of those regimes interfere with the core constitutional freedom that the electoral system is supposed to preserve. But, you know, I can imagine a court going the other way. So that's why it would be important to have both issues before the court to allow them to say, look, one thing for sure, you can't fire somebody because you don't like their vote. That's what elector means. But you might be able to create mechanisms to create confidence in your electors. That Washington state mechanism might not be the right one, but there might be others that create enough of an incentive to make sure your elector does what you intend them to do.
Really weird to me. How is it? How in the world does this come down to the national election for the president? Comes down to whether or not can we squeeze $1,000 out of some elector or not? Like, how does that work?
Well, you know, it's not my burden to argue that the system is a sensible system. Indeed, you know, I think
I wasn't putting that on you. Yeah, I just I'm just confused.
Well, yeah. I mean, this is just a consequence of, you know, not doing the work to update the Constitution to what we actually now believe it should be. You know, I think practically every single American would think that, you know, the election needs to be decided on the basis of how citizens vote. And while, you know, I actually have an idea of what the right amendment would look like that would, you know, be something both sides could endorse. And that amendment is grounded on the idea that it's a good idea to basically run 51 separate elections and count up from the state level to determine that national result, just because it's so difficult to imagine running a national election with 51 jurisdictions controlling the rules of that election and somehow deciding the president on the basis of that. So I get why state-based system might make sense. But the idea that the state-based system hangs on the discretion of 270 electors is just no longer anything to do with what America thinks. And so we ought to change that or fix that before it actually causes real harm.
So, okay, you've piqued my interest. What would your proposed constitutional amendment look like?
Well, so if the core problem is, as I've described, that you have an election where the only states that matter are the so-called swing states, the first adjustment or revision of that would be to say, okay, allocate electors proportionally.
Yeah.
All right. That doesn't yet get you what you need, because even if you allocate the electors in Wyoming proportionally, still no Democrat's going to spend any time in Wyoming because, you know, you got to imagine swinging 30% of the vote to get another elector, and that's just not going to happen. So then the question is whether you should be voting as a whole or as a fractional. So the amendment I would say is, number one, electors are votes; they're not electors. Number two, the votes get allocated proportionally. Number three, they get allocated in a fractional way. So you could have 1.44267 votes as a Democrat in Montana, because that's the percentage of votes that you got in Montana. But I would keep the number of votes equivalent to the number of electors
to the Republicans who want the small state red power.
Yeah, people who think that the Electoral College right now is a good thing because it gives more power to Wyoming relative to California. I think the people on the other side who want national popular vote should be willing to give that, because that won't really matter much if we actually have a system where the presidency is being decided by an election in 50 states plus the DC, and every candidate has an incentive to pitch for votes in every single part of the country. That would make a representative president, even if there's a slight compromise produced by this, plus two created by the way the Electoral College allocates electors.
Well, and that would dovetail very nicely with Thomas's plan to solve the potential apportionment problem looming in 2021 of doubling the size of the U.S. Congress.
Yeah,
right.
The even better version from my perspective. I mean, you know, I very much support national popular vote, even though I think there's real problems to implementing. But, you know, from my perspective, a perspective that cares about one person, one vote, even better formula would be to say each state gets a certain number of votes. The number of votes they get is the number of senators they have plus two times the number of representatives or three times the number of representatives, right? So each time you multiply the number of representatives, you're getting closer and closer to a really right. proportional number in each state. But still, so long as there are two senators, there's a thumb on the scale in favor of small states over big states.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense to me. You mentioned sort of the National Popular Vote Compact. We talked about that at the outset of the show. To me, I think I think there's sort of a lot of skepticism of at least folks on the left feel like, hey, we've mostly played by the rules for the past 20 years, and we've gotten rewarded with Mitch McConnell. And there was, I'm trying to remember who the authors of Constitutional Hardball are, but a pretty well-known law review article that sort of documents that in areas of pushing the line, going up to the line, obliterating the line, objectively speaking, it is Republicans that have broken constitutional norms at a rate far larger than Democrats. You mentioned other problems that you see implementationally. What are those? What are those that you're thinking of?
Well, I think that there's a constitutional threat. I don't believe that this is a good argument, but I can see the structure of the argument against the National Popular Vote Compact, which would go something like this. The framers envisions a kind of majority of the majority system. You find the majority of electors by identifying majorities in each of these separate states. And the National Popular Vote Compact tries to hack around that by determining the president based on either a majority or a plurality in a popular vote, and that's inconsistent with that framing presupposition. And you can imagine the conservatives raising that presupposition to a constitutional rule. I don't think that's supported, but that's the possible move. But even if you had that, even if you survive that, I do think there are practical issues we need to worry about with national popular vote that we've not yet spent enough time focused on. For example, you know, there's a kind of race to the bottom, which is in some sense a good thing, but will create anxiety. You know, what if California said 16-year-olds can vote? Do we count the votes of 16-year-olds, compared to New York, where it's 18-year-olds who can vote? So, you know, one question is just the whole idea of a national election based on standards that can vary state to state. And then the other question that people raise, and I haven't seen this gamed out in a really robust or rigorous way, but you can get the intuition, is if you've got a national election, you've got 1,000 different places where you might raise a question about recount that could slow the process down dramatically. I mean, you know, Florida in 2000 was a nightmare, but imagine three Floridas around the country, each plausibly affecting the ultimate result. My view is that if that happens, National Popular Vote Compact might be the shortest lived compact in the history of compacts, because it might work once, but then people would abolish it immediately because they're like, we just can't have, you know, such craziness. So the advantage of the amendment that I'm talking about is it still would be state by state. You know, you still would be the ultimate calculation would be a determination of 51 jurisdictions and the anomalies of 51 jurisdictions. You know, California could decide to have 16-year-olds vote. That wouldn't affect New York because California would still be just allocating their electoral votes over New York's electoral votes that might be determined in a different way.
Right. Okay. Well, let me ask kind of the terminal question, and you know, we could maybe delve a little bit into originalism and how some of the briefs in these cases seemed to have been pitched at maybe the Supreme Court as the ultimate arbiter. How do you think do you think the Supreme Court will grant cert? I take it that that's probably a yes. And then B, how do you think they're going to come out?
So yes, the court will grant cert. B is really, really interesting. You know, my view is I got into this originally thinking I'm not sure what the answer is, but there needs to be an answer. So regardless, let's do this. The more I've looked at it, the deeper I've gotten into the history and into the law, I just don't see how they write an opinion that says anything other than electors are free. I just don't understand how it's done, because there's so much else in constitutional law that would be, you know, thrown up because of such an opinion. So on the one hand, I'm not sure that a world where electors can change their votes is the best possible world. So on the one hand, I wouldn't be upset if the court found a way to say that electors have to vote according to their pledge. I would be very interested to read that opinion. You know, I teach constitutional law, so that would be a really interesting opinion to teach, because I don't see how it fits with the jurisprudence, especially the jurisprudence of the conservatives. You know, if you've got five justices of the Supreme Court who say they're originalists, look, the originalist argument here is as clear as any originalist argument could be. And so if you're an originalist, you've got to vote that electors are free. And then once you do that, then what? You know, it's going to be a hard case for them. You know, that's why I actually think that part of our job is to also prepare, you know, what the right repair would look like. One thing people don't focus on enough with amendments, you know, people assume that amendments could take forever, and most of them do, but that's only because all but one amendment has been sent out to state legislatures. But the 21st Amendment was sent out to state conventions, and basically the conventions were scheduled one on top of another. So within 6 months, the 21st Amendment was passed. You know, so you could imagine, like, if the Supreme Court decided in, you know, May, that electors are free, you could imagine amendments that reverse that before the next election, number one. But I would say to people who want to fix the Electoral College, don't just reverse that. You know, have an amendment that says electors have to vote their conscience, number one. Number two, starting in 2024, create the right Electoral College system. It would be wrong to try to change the rules, you know, in June of 2020 for the 2020 election. But you could passed an amendment in, you know, December of 2020 that sort of said, look, when the electors cast their vote, they cast their vote according to their state, number one. And number two, starting in the next election cycle, we're going to have proportional allocation, fractional allocation, according to electoral votes for casting the Electoral College. And that seems to me to be an answer which every side should be okay with, and they would be motivated to adopt it if the Supreme Court said electors are free.
Can I put on my tinfoil hat for 1 second? Just you can feel free. You guys can both dismantle it if you want. Is there a possibility that this right wing dominated court would prefer to punt and allow it to be up in the air so that the election happens and they can see which way they would need it to go, and then issue some sort of Bush v. Gore type opinion to get the outcome they want? Or is that too paranoid?
So I think that it's possible there is a justice on the court who would think like that. I am certain the Chief Justice does not want that. Like, the Chief Justice has shown his cards again and again to be a kind of justice who is deeply concerned about the institutional viability of the Supreme Court. And the one thing that court learned, kind of like Vietnam America, the one thing that court learned after Bush v. Gore was it paid a huge institutional price for that decision. Not as much as people thought. I mean, it turned out the public had confidence in the court pretty quickly afterwards again. But they don't want to do that, you know, regularly. So if there's a way to avoid doing that, I think, you know, certainly the majority would want to take it, even if there would be one who would say, let's just figure out how we can hang back and make sure that Donald Trump is president again.
so that yeah, that's another vote for the John Roberts institutionalist thesis, or as we call it on the show, the game is Shame Justice Roberts. I'm serious. I mean, like, this is a sidebar. This is my view on the Ross decision. I think minus the Hofeller evidence coming out, I mean, it clearly looks to me like that decision was written the other way.
Absolutely. Yeah. But you know, I'm not so much sure that's Shame Justice Roberts as much as Justice Roberts very deeply concerned that the institution looked ridiculous. You know, and basically the Hofeller evidence, when it comes out in its full light, you know, Dave Daly's recent piece is a huge contribution to that. But when it comes out in its full light, it's going to demonstrate the deep, you know, the games that were being played behind the scenes, and they just didn't want to be on the hook for that. So, you know, I think that's evidence on the side of a guy concerned deeply with the long-term position of the institution.
I agree with you. We just did another deep dive into the North Carolina gerrymandering decision. So maybe we'll have you back on to talk gerrymandering. Is there a subject you're not an expert in?
Yes, many. Just ask my kids.
Fair enough. Thomas, anything else you wanted to ask?
I mean, it is a little hard for a non-lawyer to follow all these, you know, everything, but I guess I'm just confused. If you could give a quick end of interview summary here, how in the world has this not been decided before in the year of our Lord 2019? This thing has been around, this clunky electoral college has been around the whole time, right? How has this never been determined before?
Well, it's never really mattered before. It mattered for the vice presidential election in like 1836, I believe, but it's never really mattered for the president. And states have only recently started enforcing these, you know, faithless electors provisions aggressively recently. So Washington State was the first state in the history of the nation to fine electors for voting contrary to their pledge, even though there have been 167 electors in the course of history who voted contrary to their pledge. So it's only recently become an issue. And the only time it first became an issue was during the Dixiecrats time, you know, when the Southern Democrats were not willing to follow the Democratic Party as it became more interested in civil rights. Strom Thurmond and other Dixiecrats started threatening that there would be electors who would just vote contrary to the Democratic Party pledge. And that's when you begin to see pledges required. That's when you begin to see states trying to figure out ways to coerce their electors into voting one way or the other. So we've had a long history with the Electoral College, but the actual regulation of electors is very recent, which again, for the conservatives, I think is going to be a very significant fact. This is not something that's been from time immemorial, that electors have been fined when they vote contrary to their pledge. It's never happened before. And so I think the presumption in the favor of tradition is going to be on our side, not the states.
I see. So it's never been the case that, like, there have been faithless electors in history, but it's not really mattered. And it hasn't really been, except for that one vice presidential election, it hasn't been like this one, you know, elector decided the whole thing by going against the will of the state. And so therefore that would have ensured a showdown in the courts. So that's just never happened.
Exactly. And the other thing that's really important here is, historically, electoral college results have been quite lopsided, even when elections are close. But because of the changing demographics, that's what's not going to be in our future. You're going to see a regular pattern of close electoral college results. Not necessarily like 2000, where, you know, two votes determined the difference between winner and loser, but still within the range of handful of votes. And that's, again, why we think it's really important to resolve this before it actually causes a crisis.
Well, unless we can swing Texas finally to go blue as it's been threatening to go, then it pretty much, that would solve a lot of problems, wouldn't it? We wouldn't even have to argue about this.
Depends on your perspective.
Yeah, true. All right, fair enough.
All right. Well, Professor Lessig, thank you very much for joining us on the show and for breaking down the Electoral College, the Bakke decision, the Garrett decision, next steps, three separate rabbit trails. It's always a pleasure to have you on.
Thank you so much for having me back.
All right, and now it's time for our top patrons. It's Top Patron Tuesday. We thank our Hall of Famers, our all-time greats. And I'll start first. Let's start with, let me be totally clear, I like Seattle live shows. Ian Buckley, Jim, Gerald Sheppins, Adam Larson, Kristen Daniel. This Christmas, adopt a Republican, change their mind on impeachment. Good luck. Be easier to adopt a child than that. A 10-year-old hooker. Another a lot of awful movies to reference, by the way. Just that's not apropos of nothing. I see how that sounds. It's a reference. Don't worry. Murray Gregerson, Hillary 2020 number one supporter Miranda Devine, Lawfulcopter, Amber Green. India is shooting students protesting against bigotry. Ugh, yikes. Can we get CERT to appeal all of Thomas's incorrect T3B answers? I'm sure we're going to add one to that in a few minutes here. Rediscovering the lost city of Atlanta. Seattle or Portland live show, I'll bring scotch. Uncle Clarence, UBI is a tax on illegal immigration and you get a rebate. Mr. Flibble and the Taint Team using hex vision to stop Trump. Portland live show, who will not be overthrown, pause for effect. Rab, Zirkle, Freudian faceplant. The next patron also wants a Raleigh live show. Not all Republicans are squirrels, but all squirrels are Republicans. I'm in for dinner in Seattle. Does Sunday, January 10th work for everybody? They're going to have it scheduled before we even figure it out. Like, it'll all be settled. I can't wait. Find a venue for us, I guess. I don't know. Emily Rainbow Spence, let him go, let him go. Let's impeach this mofo. The unprecedented, resented, demented, present, defenestrated. Jason Copas, play Sam B's app. Liz Warren needs just a little more to beat Yang. If you do a live show in Raleigh, you can snuggle my doggies. Okay. Michael Blevins, running for Senate to replace Joni Ernst, OA325. Looking forward to the Atlantis live show on Maritime SovSit Law. Hotspear.com, open water swim buoys to keep you visible and your valuable safe. Shout out to the SGU Forums Politics subforum. Alec M. Key, it's legal, it's advice, it's not legal advice. Dragonfly.eco, books about nature and the environment, reviews and interviews. You can make more money with a flop than you can with a hit. Seattle Live Show, we'll cook platinum dinner in my house, I have whiskey. Michelle Cloud, Catherine Connell, Nate Drex, Stuffin' Poles, Fog Raw in every pot and a car in every wine cave.
You know, having been to a wine cave, like I'm really torn on this latest, you know,
I knew you had Liz been to Warren a wine line cave. Of attack. Yeah.
But anyway, keep going. This is about our patrons, not about me.
Resolved. OA should adopt a policy to do a live show in Cleveland. Hey, wine cave live show, that's not impossible. Like, it's not 0%. Does anybody have a wine cave we can do a live show?
I'm down
show
for
in?
That.
Darth Mandy Pans. Eminem Brewing. 13th century Saxony gravel truck lawyer. The Mandarin. Pain Don't Hurt. Jennifer Cratch. Nightmare on Pennsylvania Avenue. A GoFundMe to fire Mitch McConnell into the sun. A series of unfortunate MacGuffins. Stephen Balticate Sandoval. I'm here because Diogenes the Cynic was right. Jeff Gelbach, all I want for Christmas is lobster coffee. For it's 1, 2, 3,000 strikes you're impeached at the corrupt intention game. The man, DeLorean, wants an Atlanta live show. Wow, that's several votes for an Atlanta live show. I never would have thought of it, but I guess maybe. Norfolk, Nebraska, famous for Johnny Carson, Melons, and Summit Shuffleboard. CivilPoliticsRadio.com, Fridays at 7 p.m. Eastern on Valley Free Radio. Andrea the Arbitrary and Capricious, the Registry Matters podcast, John Bilderback, and Sternly Worded live show in Seattle. Your turn, Andrew.
And thank you to, if using the power of your office to corrupt an election is abuse of power, I'm sure that was really funny, but it's like a paragraph long. P. Andrew Tortoise, Clownhorn the live show, I just want dinner in Seattle. You know, you can get dinner in Seattle without us. I mean, clownhornvoting.com is my favorite voting site. 538 is a close second. Eric Alsman, America's pastime should be shaming racists. Payne Strumpet, Thomas Smith is my favorite attorney. Andrew is a close second. Trambolus, enjoying impeachment with Opus One Overture Napa Red Blend. Yeah, that is delicious. Kiwa Valley Exports for Australian red meat and craft beer. The Wandering Gambler, Adam Costa. Let me be totally clear. I like being totally clear. J. Aldenwalt, the Howler Monkey theory of legal interpretation is pretextualism. Milo Meadsong suggests the Chief Complaint podcast. Build the third shed, Arthur. Too many sheds is not even a thing. I will tell you, somebody posted the Arthur Two Sheds Jackson bit in the OA Facebook community. So you're still not clear on that name. That's where you can go figure it out. Excited about the Melbourne live show. That's actually on the whiteboard. Our favorite karaoke legend, Cosmo Blues. Join your favorite labor union. Together we bargain, alone we beg. The previous patron is a dick. Well, that seems mean. Arthur, considering a third shed, Jackson. James Call, 15 flushes, and what do you get? Only two articles of impeachment. This podcast is in English, right? Come on, fructose, corollary, thesaurus. Give me those sweet, sweet utils. Anonymous, Chicago Live Show will professionally sharpen Andrew's chef knives. Well, that would be an enticement. Wishing,
can I bring some knives too?
I say we do a Chicago knife sharpening party / live show. There we go. Wishing you a furry new year from Buttercup's Legal Services. Mr. Trololo was the greatest Russian yodeler. Closing concessions, wordorigins.org, your source for legal terms from 13th century Saxony. It's a yodel stairmaster and it never gets higher. Come on, come on. Lamar Jackson is my shepherd. I shall not want. Well, you were probably happy with this past game. Derek, these ballots are in English, right? Come on, Donald Trump, Boris Johnson. Denver will have our own live show with blackjack and our deference. Sharpie is bad, but at least it's not crayon. Sam Buck, Big Easy Blasphemy, David in Brooklyn, a string of unpronounceable characters. Rhonda, the ex-parrot. We're just going to work through all of the Monty Python sketches now, huh? The look on Nunez's face is my favorite look on anyone's face ever. Good morning, Camp Quest. Malika Chandler, Abacus Flinch, Soggy Pants, Greg Sullivan, Matthew Vernon, adopt a homeless pet and post declawing and ear ducking. Don't take ramp building advice from a podcast. Heather Loveridge, Sam Danow, F you. Jeremiah's Fancy Microwave Emporium, Ian and Allie, Danny Rosari, Eli Bosnick, Alexandra Chalupa, a.k.a. Natasha Crunchwrap. I still laugh at that. Zabby, all I want for Christmas is lobster coffee and a hot lunch. Mitchell, Brian, punch it. Oh, that's another Thomas fan of your instructions to Brian. The previous patron speaks truth. I agree with that 100%.
Yeah.
And, of course, our all-time great, he who shall never be dethroned, Conrad Michaels. Thank you all so much. And, again, remember, you're sitting on a little extra holiday cash. Patreon.com/law. $5 an episode. You get. We will read out any crazy thing you want us to read out, you know, within reason and the character limits. And we'll do that every single week. Get in on all this fun.
All right. Now it's time for me to get in on the fun of getting this question wrong. It's T3BE.
Oh, no associate of this firm has ever failed the bar exam.
Talk to the hand. I need your clothes. That's one of my mission parameters. Trust me. I know now why you cry.
I can't wait to hear the explanation for this one.
Yep. Really straightforward explanation. So complicated fact pattern. This was executive gets fired, goes back to the premises, intending to get her personal stuff, gets there, breaks in, goes to her office, takes a whole bunch of stuff, including stuff that she knows isn't hers because of the whole light being off thing, gets home, finds that, and by the way, this is all totally irrelevant, gets home, finds that she's taken record book and financial papers and burns them in the fireplace. That's a total unattractive distractor. The question is, what crimes has she committed? You went with burglary and larceny, which is wrong, I will tell you. And you kind of went under the theory that you started to express of, she's done a whole bunch of stuff, so I'm just going to pick the broadest possible answer. That's probably a bad guessing advice for the bar.
I wasn't proud of this one.
Yeah. The correct answer is where you went immediately after picking your answer. You were like, oh, yeah, I forgot about the whole breaking and entering thing. Could be C, larceny, but not burglary. That is, in fact, the case. It is larceny, but not burglary.
Yeah.
And the reason for that is because the crime of burglary requires unauthorized breaking and entry, which you have, with into a building or occupied structure, right? And the test specifies that burglary includes all buildings, right? So, which you have. With the intent to commit a crime while you're inside, which you do not have, because her intent was to get her stuff back. You do, however, have larceny, because larceny is the wrongful carrying or taking away of the personal goods of another with the intent to convert them for your own use. And here you have that because the intent transfers once you decide that you're going to burn the documents instead of return them. And so I guess I'm overruling the test here, because the test says, and I just think this is not correct. The test says she did, however, commit larceny under the theory of continuing trespass, which I don't think is the right reason for it being larceny. I think the reason that it's larceny is because she's got stuff that she knows that belongs to somebody else and decides not to return them. And so under the theory of transferred intent, right, that would then make that complete the act of larceny. So I think the test is wrong and I'm right, which also gives sense to the reason for the additional stuff with the burning the book in the fireplace.
Well, but also,
which otherwise the test doesn't.
We didn't even talk about the sentence that made no difference. The jurisdiction has expanded the crime of burglary to include all buildings. Is that just like trying to throw you?
Oh, no. Because at common law, you had to break into an occupied structure.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Huh. So, yeah, abandoned building, you know, warehouse that's vacant, no burglary into that. And so most jurisdictions have by statute expanded burglary to be breaking and entering into a locked building, whether there's someone in there or not.
Huh? Yeah. You would think that would, otherwise, again, the Hamburglar is the Ham Larson. whatever. Okay.
So there you go.
Yeah. I should have tried harder. I'll be honest. It was just too much Christmas. I don't know. I knew it wasn't A, and I shouldn't have said that. I just was thinking, you know, I couldn't quite decide. So I choked.
We still,
you know, it's high pressure test taking scenario. Yeah.
That's what they try and do to you, man.
Well, I blew it. Let's hop in the time machine, find out who this week's big winner is.
Meanwhile, at the Hall of Justice.
All right, Thomas, this week's winner is Alex on Twitter. That is at Langau, who writes, "Pretty sure she committed larceny. That's stealing, right? But I think burglary requires intent to commit a crime. I don't think she intended to commit a crime when she entered. She just wanted to get her stuff. So I'm going to go with C." Well, Alex, that is exactly right for exactly the right reason. So congratulations on being this week's winner. Everyone give Alex a follow. That is at Lengau on Twitter. And congratulations. Enjoy your never-ending fame and fortune.
Right, thank you so much for listening, everybody. Thanks most of all to our patrons, and we will see you back on track, all done with the holidays, for a Rapid Response Friday.
You betray the law! Law!
This has been Opening Arguments with Andrew and Thomas. If you love the show and want to support future episodes, please visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/law. If you can't support us financially, it'd be a big help if you could leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcast delivery vehicle you use. And be sure to tell all your friends about us. For questions, suggestions, and complaints, email us at openarguments@gmail.com. The show notes and links are on our website at www.openargs.com. Be sure to like our page on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @openargs. Until next time. This podcast is a production of Opening Arguments Media, LLC. All rights reserved.
Opening Arguments is a copyrighted production of Opening Arguments Media, LLC. All rights reserved. Opening Arguments is produced with the assistance of our editor, Brian Ziegenhagen, our transcriptionist, Heather Loveridge, production assistant, Ashley Smith, and with the generous assistance of our volunteer unofficial researcher, Deborah Smith. Special thanks to Teresa Gomez, who runs our merch and our live shows and also heads up the OA Wiki project. Follow them at OA Wiki. And a big thank you to our Facebook group moderators, Emily Waters, Alicia Cook, Eric Brewer, Natalie Newell, Brian, and Teresa. Check out the Opening Arguments community on Facebook. And finally, thanks to Thomas Smith for creating the fabulous OA theme song, which is used with permission.